Hey, everybody, I'm Chris Mannix from The Vertical, and welcome to The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, where I check in with some of the top players, coaches, and analysts covering the NBA. It's a two-guest podcast this week. Joining me first is Bobby Marks, the front office insider for The Vertical. I talked to Bobby about what is behind the disappointing start of the Portland Trailblazers.
There's a couple things there. The Al-Farouq Aminu injury hurt them. Your bench has been a little bit up and down. You mentioned Turner, Alan Crabb, Myers Leonard.
And later, Dan Wojcicki, the Clippers beat writer for the Orange County Register. He'll hop on and tell me what he sees from Blake Griffin, an emerging MVP candidate.
I don't think it's fun to play against him. And I don't think guys particularly like playing against him. It's really physical. You know, you're right about kind of the working of the officials and that type of stuff. And I do think that gets under people's skin a little bit.
All that and more coming up next on The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Well, welcome back to another episode of The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Got two guests for you this week. We'll be joined by Bobby Marks, the front office insider over at The Vertical. We'll take a run through the week that was in the NBA, hit a bunch of topics there. And then I'll be joined by Dan Wojcicki of the Orange County Register. Dan covers the Clippers, and we'll talk about a team that has emerged as the hottest team, the best team right now anyway, as of Monday, in the NBA. So a lot to get to today, but I want to begin with Bobby Marks, and he joins me here on the line. How are you, Bobby?
I'm good, Chris. How are you?
Oh, you know, we're now, about a month into the season. Now, from your experience with the Nets, I mean, how, when you get through a month's worth of games and you're 14, 15 games in, what do you think of as a front office guy? Do you think of like, do you look at the results and say, you know, we need to start thinking about maybe making a move, or does it take, do you have to go deeper into the season before you can really evaluate who you are?
Well, I don't think Brooklyn could be compared to anything that we've seen, because
that's true.
As you know, we the first year we were there in Brooklyn, the 12-13 season, we actually got off to a pretty good start. I think we were 6-2 to start the season, and really had a lot of new faces with Joe Johnson and full Gerald Wallace. Avery got let go in around Christmas time. Then we had PJ, so it was hard to really evaluate that group. The second year was more difficult, just because we had thought we had a roster, you know, ready to win right now. And I, you know, it was funny, I was looking at the schedule from that season, and I, you know, around Christmas time we were 7-18, somewhere around there. So, you know, and you had a lot of pieces that you really couldn't move, and you had a, goodness gracious, you had a luxury tax bill of $90 million plus. So I think for the majority of the NBA, I think you look at it in, we're looking at it in 15-game clumps right now. There's so many new coaches. There's, 10 new coaches. There's so much roster turnover from this past summer that we see teams still in that early evaluation period.
I want to just briefly touch on the Nets here, and specifically Brook Lopez, who through Monday has attempted 63 pointers. That's his career high, Bobby, up until this point was 14, and that was last season. I mean, what do you make of Lopez, a guy that you were around for most of his career, suddenly emerging as a prolific three-point shooter?
Well, I saw it in New Jersey when we drafted him, and then Brooklyn. He's had it. He's had the touch. Never really got the green light to do so. During the 14-15 season kind of tried to expand him a little bit, but was still, reluctant to do so. But, the one thing I get nervous with him is that he's got a lot of good low post moves. So I don't want him just being a stretch five, standing on top of the key, jacking up jumpers and stuff like that. So we've seen it with him and Horford, Gasol, another guy who certainly has expanded his range. But that's a dimension that Kenny Atkinson has gone with that group in Brooklyn. It's a three-point shooting team. We've seen, with the last week, though, is that they don't have the horses to outscore so many teams. We saw 129 against Portland, I think 125 against the Lakers, 127 against Oklahoma City. You know, it's fine to get up a lot of points, but when you don't have defense to get some stops, that's an issue.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Nets are going nowhere. But it's watching Lopez, who's putting up comparable numbers they did last year, right around 20 points per game, but layering the three-point shot, it's not a bad three-point shot. He's shooting 36, 37% from three-point range. I mean, that's I mean, I just never envisioned him as a stretch five. I really didn't. It changes how you have to defend this guy.
Well, you know what's interesting too is that he is, and I haven't heard anything yet as far as from a him on the move or his name being talked about. Yep. But when we get to February, he could be a prime candidate for a guy being moved.
Wait, you're telling me Brook Lopez might get traded? No, you're not telling me that.
I know he's had all those flashbacks from when I was there. I think his name was in the news for two or three years straight at least. But he would be a prime guy because he's got a pretty decent contract. He's got another year left. He's got some, there's some protection in that contract with his foot and everything. And he is a creature habit. I know him pretty well. He does not like to move around. So if you can get him, even if you get him on an expiring next year, I could see him signing up long term. He's not a guy who's looking to move around a lot.
Yeah, and he could be a difference maker if for some reason he was going to be traded. There's a lot of teams that he could help out a lot, especially offensively.
Well, you know what, Christian? Could you imagine him and Steven Adams together?
Yeah.
I mean that was almost happened, you know, 3 years ago, and how Lopez is now is that you can put Adams at the five and Lopez at the four. Can you imagine those two together?
Could Lopez really defend fours though?
Well, that's the issue, and that's where we've seen teams, especially when you go small. Can he guard a Paul Millsap? I think he'd have a hard time. Can he guard it? You know, a Sacramento if Rudy Gay's at the four. That will be the issue. Where it won't be the start of the games. It will be you know, in between and how games are finished now.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's your Brook Lopez talk for the podcast. it's Cleveland's world. It's the Clippers' world. It's the Warriors' world. We know that these teams are atop their conferences. But I want to talk today about, you know, some of the more surprising teams, good and bad. And I want to talk about the team that's right behind Cleveland in the standing. That's Atlanta. And, I mean, the Hawks, you know, they took kind of a step back last year. They lost Damari Carroll. He was a big part of their defensive identity. They weren't the team we saw before, and they once again got waxed in the first round by the Cavaliers. They make the changes this summer. They move Jeff Teague and kind of anoint Dennis Schroeder as their starting point guard. And they bring in Dwight Howard, you know, one of the most polarizing players in the NBA, and effectively swap him out for Al Horford. And it's all worked, Bobby. It's all worked for this team. You know, Schroeder has been great. Dwight Howard has added a physical dimension to this team that they did not have prior. I mean, I look at Atlanta, and I don't say that they're a true threat to the Cavs, even though they beat them early in the season. But I think you can make a solid argument that this is the best Hawks team in the Mike Budenholzer era.
Well, I think it's the deepest team, and you have, and the big question with Atlanta going into the year was Dennis Schroeder with Teague being moved to Indiana, and now you kind of, you know, give him the full reign, and we saw some good things in that Boston series last year, and we saw some not good things. So that was always the big question. Now you insert Howard, you take out Horford. What Dwight Howard were you going to get? And you've been a big proponent of him all along, and you've got him on a 3-year, $70 million contract. He's, I mean, 30 years old. He's averaging 14 and 13 in 28 minutes, and he fits. He fits. You're not asking him to get you 30 and 20, but maybe he can, you know, in a given night. And you've got a rejuvenated Kyle Korver. You've got Cephalosha. Even some of the younger kids haven't really, you know, with Torian Prince and DeAndre Bembry, haven't had to do much. Tim Hardaway Jr., I thought he was done in training camp. He couldn't hit anything, and now he's sixth man of the year candidate. And then Malcolm Delaney, who played over in Europe for the last couple of years as a backup. We thought Jarrett Jack was going to get that. So
yeah, they like Malcolm Delaney.
They do, and it's a well-rounded team, and it's a good coach. But as you said, it's Cleveland, and then there's a lot of good tier B teams with Atlanta and Toronto, Charlotte. We could put Chicago in there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, with Dwight in particular, you know, I always thought that the negatives were kind of overshadowing the positive about him, and the negatives were kind of blown up, and the positives were kind of marginalized to some degree. And now when Dwight's in the lineup, when talking with people in Atlanta over the last week, it's their ability to be physical and their ability to alter shots. Like their block shots are not noticeably different this year statistically. But what people in the organization point out is the stuff that doesn't make the stat sheets, and that's altered shots and shots that guys just don't take because Dwight is standing in the paint. They say that number has increased by a lot with this team this year. And I know it's just one game, but I go back to the way they played against Cleveland early in the season, a team that had beaten them 11 consecutive games leading up to that point. Atlanta went in there and Schroeder played well, and Dwight had 17 rebounds, and the Hawks won a battle again on the glass with the Cleveland Cavaliers. That never happens. Now, I'd like to see someone kind of emerge in the small forward position and maybe seize that and play a little bit better there. But I think with Dwight, you know, as a presence there, I mean, he's really good. I mean, he's a really good big addition for them.
Well, it's funny you talk about that. And I went and saw them last week against Miami, and that's probably not the game you want to go evaluate Dwight Howard, because Hassan Whiteside put up 19 and 25 and Howard wound up getting hurt in that game. And I think when you look at guys like Whiteside, and there's a lot, I mean, you look across the league, I mean, Whiteside is a monster right now. And so if you compare those two, I don't think it's fair right now, but the role for Howard fits him. And the big knock with him is that, you know, it looks like he's almost having too much fun on the court. You know, he always has that smile on his face, and there's nothing wrong with that. And now they're winning, and now we don't hear much about him. When he was on a losing team or a team last year in Houston that struggled, then it was about Dwight Howard. But now you're 9-4 or 10-4, and you're the second best record in the Eastern Conference, and now he fits well in which he does in Atlanta.
Yeah, when I say that small forward position, I mean kind of off the bench, somebody as a scorer with that second group. Obviously, Kent Bazemore is very good for them at that position. But their ability to defend without fouling, their ability to be as physical with teams, that's not something that you saw from the Hawks over these last couple of years. I'd like to see Dwight healthy for an entire season and then see what happens. But I mean, you just don't need him to be 20-12 Dwight anymore. He's not, I don't think he's capable of that, but you don't need him to be that. Right now, he's around 15 points, 13 rebounds. I mean, any team in the league would take that. And the Hawks certainly will jump all over it. I mean, I'm sure they miss Al Horford and that leadership and his offensive versatility. But I mean, they've got Millsap and he can do a bunch of different things. I just look at Dwight and man, if he can just give you 75 games this year, if he can be healthy for the postseason, that's going to be a tough matchup. They're going to be a tough out for anyone outside of Cleveland, the Eastern Conference.
Well, that's why it's so important, Chris, during the summer when you are a free agent, and sometimes it isn't all about money, is finding the right team. I mean, could you imagine him on Dallas right now?
Yeah.
I mean, it would probably be the end of him, and he'd probably have 2 or 3 years wasted there and making, you know, $20-25 million or whatever the number would be. And we would probably not hear Dwight Howard in a conversation that we're talking about right now. But he, you know, Horford going to Boston created a domino effect, and he slid right back in there and was able to go home and find a nice role for this team. And that's the big thing. It's sometimes it's not always about money, although he didn't get a nice contract, but it's about fit. It's about style of play, having a coach there. And Mike Budenholzer. I mean, we haven't even talked about Millsap. I mean, having a legit power forward next year. Those are the big things.
Yeah, and I think what I'm going to be watching is how cool is he with the number of touches he's getting. He's only averaging about 9 attempts per game. He and Tim Hardaway Jr. basically have the same amount of attempts per game. He's well behind Millsap, behind Schroeder, behind Bazemore. We've heard Dwight complain about touches in the past. Will he be satisfied with his role in the offense, which, you know, doesn't emphasize him at all? I mean, right now, you know, you ask Budenholzer and the players there, it's not a very different offensive system than they had in years past, and Dwight's not getting consistent posts up there. So I'll be watching that moving forward. On the other side of the ledger, as far as disappointing teams go, you know, Portland right now hovering right around 500. They've been blown out of some games that they shouldn't even be losing, much less being blown out of. The Pelicans being a recent example. Hey, what do you make of what you've seen out of Portland, Bobby? Because I really liked the Evan Turner acquisition. I guess I understood why they matched the offer to Allen Crabbe, even though Crabbe had been a good player, but not a great player. But this team has, you know, either maintained kind of the status quo or regressed in some areas this year.
Well, you're right. I mean, there's a couple things there. The Al-Farouq Aminu injury hurt them, just because now you went from a lineup that was consistent to now you're juggling one. You've had, you know, four different lineups over the, you know, last couple of weeks here. Your bench has been a little bit up and down. You mentioned Turner, Allen Crabbe, Myers Leonard. We did see them have a good night in Brooklyn on Sunday. The trend for them has always been Lillard and McCollum will get theirs. You know, they're right now they're combined for, you know, averaging 50 points a game, but they're two games better than they were a year ago at this point. Same roster, but you do have an Evan Turner, and it's still a young team. So did success come a little bit too quickly? Did they overachieve a little bit last year? And, you know, they got fortunate in the Clipper series with all those injuries. So yeah. I think you take a lot of those into equation. Are they in that Golden State, San Antonio, Clipper, you know, tier A's? I don't think so. I think they're in that next group there, which is fine. I think there's still some time to grow. And I just wrote about them that we'll have some out here. And I think if you look at them, if you are Neil O'Shea and you had the third highest payroll and you had an aging group and you're 500 right now, yeah. Do you look at try to move some pieces around? I think you do, but I think for this roster, you let it just breathe a little bit and let it play out. But they dodged a bullet. We talked about Turner. Could you imagine Chandler Parsons there right now?
Yeah.
I mean, he's hurt again with, I think it's the other knee. And can you imagine if he's there $5 million more than what Turner's making, and now you got a $115-15 million payroll and you got a small forward who's injured. And that was the other guy they were kind of dancing with a little bit in July. So I would rather have Turner, and you know what you're going to get every night. And he was good in the Brooklyn game. He's consistent. He's durable. There's not much flash with him. And I think them falling in at 45-46 number is more realistic than them being in the 50s and being a team like, you know, the Clippers or, you know, San Antonio.
Yeah, I think Turner gets better as he gets more comfortable with that team. He was so good last year for Boston. I mean, he was, you know, he sort of recreated himself as a sixth man. He was no longer Evan Turner, number two overall pick from Philadelphia. He was Evan Turner, you know, Brad Stevens glue guy off the bench who, you know, played shooting guard, but doubled as a point guard and was a playmaker with the Celtics last year. I got to believe that wasn't an aberration. He was just so comfortable in that role that plugged into this same role in Portland. He'll eventually shine. I'm less sure, Bobby, about Allen Crabb. I mean, he's okay, but now he's the 70 whatever million dollar man or whatever amount of money he got there, and he's kind of plateaued a little bit there. And I don't see great chemistry between Turner and Crabb in on that second unit. That to me, it worries me a little bit about this team. The other part of it is expectations can kill you sometimes. I mean, this team, you know, we call them, and you brought this up, we call them a second-round team. But they're not really. I mean, they're a second-round team because the Clippers basically became a MASH unit at the end of that first-round series, and they couldn't do anything to stop the momentum Portland had. And Portland goes out and has, you know, a couple of good games against the Warriors, but you know, they're probably a first round type of team. They're only a mid 40s win type of team. That might be what we're kind of looking at until they can get somebody at that power forward position to kind of step out, distinguish himself as an offensive player, some consistency from somebody at that center position. I mean, this is a very guard oriented team that maybe they're just kind of a good team right now and not ready to take that next jump.
Well, and that's going to be the hard sell for GM Neil O'Shea when he's selling ownership this up next summer, when you got to deal with Mason Plumlee with his contract. Because what happens if you lose in the first round? Your payroll is already $127 million. You add another $20 million, and you're going to have $150 million payrolls. So that's going to be that, and I think that's kind of where you see some of these restricted free agents that they wind up signing or matching the Allen Crabbs. You know, he basically has a no trade right now, and Myers Leonard and Harkless has been really good for them. So those pieces kind of become more expendable because Plumlee's more of a value. So that's going to be the thing to watch with Portland as far as from a domino effect, because sure, when you lose in the first round and your payroll is so high, albeit not a tax team right now, you know, You know, your owner comes to you and says, well, can you win it? Can we produce at, you know, a $90 million payroll? And that's when you're a GM, you're trying to, you know, juggle that roster. So I think it's okay right now. It's a consistent evaluation. They'll be fine. I think how the West is starting to at least shake up a little bit. They'll be in that, you know, they'll be in that 5-8 range, maybe even to sneak up in four, maybe.
Oh, man. You mentioned Plumlee and the money he could potentially get. I'd be real nervous about giving him big money. I mean, he's a good player. But look at, like, you know, we mentioned the Nets earlier. And are the Nets not better off right now that the Heat and the Blazers match those contract offers to Allen Crabb and Tyler Johnson? I mean, I know that there's holes in Brooklyn, but I'm not sure I'd want to be paying either one of those guys the type of money they're getting.
Well, you're right. And I've learned that one of the guys they were high on from a free agent standpoint was Joakim Noah. I mean, man. Can you,
Knicks will trade him. I think the Knicks might be willing to trade him right now.
Could you imagine him there right now and how he's been? And I agree with you on Crabbe. I like Johnson, but not at 50 million. And, he's a bench guy. He's not a starter, but I guess he fit what Brooklyn was trying to do, but at least, I don't see how much of a different the Nets record would be with both those guys right now. I don't think, they're currently at 4 wins. I don't see, them getting 6 wins or 7 and with either guy. So yeah, I would say, yes, you dodged a bullet. Now you got to figure out what you want to do next summer with free agency.
And the Nets at 4 wins as of Monday afternoon, they are 1 win better than the Washington Wizards right now, who have the same number of wins as Philadelphia, who has beaten them this year. I mean, I was high on the Wizards coming into the season as a back end playoff team. I thought Scott Brooks could make a pretty big difference there, but man, that roster and it's just not getting the job done. I mean, they've still got the good players in the backcourt. Bradley Beal, though, banged up again. I don't know how quickly this thing turns around, Bobby, in Washington.
Well, it's twofold. I mean, the bench, Chris, is not very good at all, and we knew that going into the year. There were some really question marks. The Mahinmi injury certainly hurts them, but they weren't very deep as is. Trey Burke from Utah, I mean, he was checkered, pass from on a court standpoint. Nicholson, Jason Smith, those are your big free agent acquisitions. Kelly Oubre Jr. You had somewhat of a minutes restriction on Wall. Beal can't play back to back. There's a lot of different moving pieces here. And it's funny you mentioned that Philly game. I'm watching it and I don't know why I'm thinking about Randy Whitman. And I'm thinking about it and I'm thinking if Randy Whitman was the coach right now, he would not have made it to the next day.
No.
And I think with Scott Brooks, you got to let it give it some time here. But I don't see how much these guys are going to get better either, unless you're going to get some really high level performances from Wall and Beal. And Beal's always a wild card just because of from a health standpoint and him being able to be out there all the time.
Yeah, they opened up some minutes for these young guys, and these young guys in general really haven't performed at the highest level. I mean, I don't think there should be any clamor for Scott Brooks' job, regardless of his contract situation. But the fact is, he's got a 5-year contract and he's making $7 million per year. So if anyone's going to go, it's probably somebody in that front office before it's going to be Scott Brooks with this group. So I think it's going to be a long season. I don't know that a lot of this is fixable in the short term for the Wizards.
No, you're right. And you're starting to you're starting to see a little bit of separation, and you've got a bunch of teams, 6 and 7 teams that you have to leapfrog. And I just don't see this team stringing together 3 or 4 wins in a row. I think you can do, 1 or 2 games and then, lose 2 or 3. That's going to be the hard part, is trying to find some consistencies. But that team never has really gotten off to a strong start. I know when I was in Brooklyn, they always struggled in the beginning, and then they kind of figured it out mid-year. But I don't know if they have enough good players right now, or at least healthy players, to get, try to win some games here and get back to 500.
All right, so the Houston Rockets right now, let's look at them for a second. I still don't know how they're going to get enough stops to be effective in the playoffs, but their D'Antoni-like philosophy of outscoring teams is kind of working right now. I mean, 8-5 as of Monday afternoon. They beat Portland. They beat Utah. They've beaten some good teams. San Antonio is on that list. The James Harden experiment as, scorer/playmaker seems to be working out. Now, I have some question marks about whether or not he's going to be able to sustain this level of play, given how much responsibility he has with this offense. But look, I'll give D'Antoni credit where it's due. I mean, this team is better than I thought they were going to be.
Well, they are, and I mean, how fun is James Harden to watch?
Oh man, he's like league pass guy.
I mean, I was watching him against Portland the other night, and I mean, some of the things he's able to do. And my question with Houston going into the year was, health. I mean, a lot of teams you can talk about, but health, Ryan Anderson, Eric Gordon, and Gordon has been really good. You know, he's come off the bench, you know, recently and has really given him a nice spark. And I had Ryan in New Jersey, and, you know, probably one of the worst trades we ever did was trade him to Orlando for Tony Batty and Courtney Lee to try to clear cap space. And Ryan has really fit a nice role, and they're a good team right now. Well, you know, they're in the mix. They're in with Portland and Oklahoma City, but they can certainly outscore you and, you know, and find enough defense when you need to.
You mentioned Vince still playing at a high level. He is in his 18 years in the NBA, 39 years old. In January, he's going to turn 40. And look at he's playing. He's in the Memphis rotation at right around, you know, what, 20 minutes per game or something like that. Some of them are more. I mean, he's playing 26, at least 26 most nights. I mean, how is Vince Carter still this effective? I mean, it's amazing watching him continue to perform at this level.
Well, it's funny, Chris. We signed him to that long-term contract in New Jersey in 2006, and my now 10-year-old was just born then. And it feels like, I mean, you look at him, and I thought he was done last year because, you know, he was not as effective, but, you know, he's put some strong, you know, minutes as a rotational player right now and has really helped them. And I didn't think he had much left in the tank at all. But he certainly has, and he really has embraced his role there. He has turned into a great leader. I saw him in Summer League down in Orlando, and he's sitting at the end of the bench, and he's coaching these guys, some of these young kids up, and has really enjoyed his time down in Memphis with. And that's a veteran group, but they've sprinkled some of these young kids there. But I am stunned that Vince Carter is still playing. I thought his days in Dallas would have been it, and then you know, he would have retired and gone into broadcasting. But he's still playing and able to produce.
Yeah, and he wants to keep playing for, I think, at least a couple more years. Wants to get into the 20-year range, if not beyond, which then begs the question, Bobby, is Vince Carter a Hall of Famer? This is going to get kicked around a lot in the coming years, but what do you think?
I think he is. You know, I hate when, you know, you talk about when they look at baseball players and they say guys who are compilers and they guys who, you know, play a lot and, you know, either from an RBI standpoint and hits and because of your years of service. But he's done so much. And we, you know, a lot of people nowadays forget about him in Toronto and how good he was. And he saved the Nets, the then New Jersey Nets, from where they were after they had traded Kenyon Martin. And when we got Vince in 2004, he saved them for 3 years and kept that organization afloat. You know, did some good things in Orlando and then Dallas and then Memphis. But his time in Toronto was as good from the slam dunk contest and I guess it was in Golden State that year to, you know, getting that team to the playoffs where it was an expansion team a couple of years before and kind of put them on the map. And I know it didn't end well there, but I do believe he is certainly Hall of Fame worthy.
What do you see when you watch him defensively? Because look, there are a lot of guys that could probably still score in the NBA, but the only way you get on the floor is if you're at least a competent defender. I mean, from what you had when he was in New Jersey to where he is now, I mean, is there a level of a craftiness to him now that he's able to kind of skate by defensively?
Well, his athleticism certainly has kind of, you know, and that goes with age, but he's smart. He knows from a rotation standpoint, he studies these guys, you know, from a video standpoint, from a scouting report, you know, and he's not relying on his athleticism because it's just not there where it was, you know, 15 years ago. So, he's had to really learn how to really reestablish his game, and that's basically what's kept him on the court.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I tend to agree with you that he's a Hall of Famer too. I mean, the longevity, the numbers he put up, you know, not the playoff success that you'd like to hope for from a player that you're considering for the Hall of Fame, but this type of output for this long, I mean, I would definitely put him in. Real quick before we go. Sacramento is well under 500 right now, which obviously, you know, begs the question of will there be a fire sale within the Kings? We know at the start of the season they wanted to keep a good group intact because they wanted to open the arena with DeMarcus Cousins and even Rudy Gay and convince their fans that they were a playoff team. They're not a playoff team. They're really not. No matter what kind of lineup changes Dave Joerger tries, they don't have quality play at the point guard spot. They're mixing and matching that front court, going big with Kufos and small with Rudy Gay. I mean, I just don't think you can scheme your way to success with that group in the Western Conference. What kind of value does a guy like Cousins have right now as he heads towards that kind of year and a half mark left in his contract in February?
Well, it depends on, you know, from a team standpoint, what your locker room is as far as how he, from a fit standpoint. I think you're going to really need to rely on your personnel guys from a scouting standpoint. I think you're going to need to dig back into your draft research from 2010 when he did all that background. And I know when we were in New Jersey, we did a ton on him as far as from looking at that, all your psych work. He's got value just based on from a skill level. He's as skilled as a big man of I've seen. And I saw Derek Coleman back in the day and, Derek was not as big as DeMarcus, but I compared both of those just because they were so, you know, from an all-star level, they can do so many different things, but they've kind of their career kind of just flatlined based on, you know, where they were. And I hope that doesn't happen with DeMarcus, but you know, he's got another year left after this year. So that now we see the clock start ticking a little bit as far as what the Sacramento team can do. And they're four games, under 500 as of a Monday night. They've got two more games this week against Oklahoma City and Houston. Then they go on the road for six games. So where are we going to be when they come back? Are you going to be at 500? Yeah. I think they'll be below. But, you know, they're another team that's playing catch up. And we still have to see. I think Minnesota will get better during the year. And I think, you know, they'll probably start sniffing, you know, possibly maybe an eight seed if they can be a little more consistent. So, you know, who are you jumping over? You know, Portland, Utah, the Lakers. So that's what you have to figure out. And it's not like you have a group of really young players. I mean, Aflalo, Matt Barnes, Garrett Temple, Collison, Ty Lawson. I mean, it's an older group. So you're going to be at a crossroads from a Kings organization as far as if you want to pull the trigger on that.
I feel the same about Cousins in a lot of ways that I did about Dwight Howard coming into his kind of a contract free agent year. I think the negatives, while they're certainly there, tend to overshadow some of the positives. And I remember watching him in Rio, Bobby, and like this was a guy that when he was around winning players in a winning environment, he just played differently. He just didn't have the constant kind of griping. You had a guy that seemingly hustled on a lot more plays than maybe he hustles on right now with the Kings. I think if you put him in a different situation, he could be an incredibly successful player. I wouldn't blink if I was a team that really liked him but was uncertain about his personality. If I was a winning team and I could plug him into my starting five position and be a lot better, I would do that in a second and not worry about the personality stuff.
Well, Chris, losing wears on people. I mean, can you imagine being somewhere
the coaching changes he's had over the years? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, yeah, you've been there since 2010. You've never sniffed the playoffs, and you've had, what, five or six different head coaches. Yeah. I mean, that wears on different players. And are there times on the court when, from a facial standpoint, do you wish he would do certain things different? Sure. But from a, you know, from a physical, from what he can offer, and if I had a team that I knew had a strong locker room and had a strong coach, I would have no reservation at all regarding DeMarcus Cousins.
All right, Bobby, I appreciate it. Next time we'll let you take even more credit for Brooke Lopez's success as a three-point shooter.
I will.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. It's the MMQB podcast with Peter King.
What appealed to you early on about Brett Favre?
I can't help but think that a lot of it was his personality and who just the way he came across. I think that people wanted to meet him, and not just because he was a great quarterback, but also just because he seemed like, you know, everybody else.
The MMQB podcast with Peter King. Subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And now a word from Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. Fast, powerful, and completely online, Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts out of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. Hate searching through stacks of old files and paperwork? With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button, helping you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your unique financial situation. Even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all this on your phone or tablet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/Mannix. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
Hi, boys and girls. It's Tony Kornheiser reminding you to subscribe and listen to my daily podcast, where we talk about everything from sports to politics to the impending animal revolution. And remember, you can listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play.
One of the bigger surprises in the Western Conference start of the season has been the play of the LA Clippers, believed certainly to be in the mix among the top teams in the West to start the season. But right now, they're looking like the class of the Western Conference. Talk more about them. Let's bring in Dan Wojcicki, the beat writer for the Orange County Register. And Dan joins me here on the podcast. Dan, let's talk first about covering the Clippers. I mean, I talk to a lot of beat guys. And of course, you know, I go to a lot of practices and games and whatnot, and talk to players. But that locker room, I mean, how would you describe it as a kind of locker room to cover?
It's been really good over the years. I mean, there certainly hasn't been a shortage of things to talk about. That's for sure. I mean, it's funny. I think every year or so, I tend to list out the things that I've had to cover this is my sixth year on the beat. And it's just like, it's a crazy, weird list of things. And then you remind yourself that this is also the best era of Clipper basketball ever. Mm-hmm. Like, that's kind of like the punchline to that. But as far as the guys in that room, there's a lot of smart guys. There's guys with strong opinions. There's one so-so podcast host.
Yes.
There's definitely people to talk. I think the kind of interesting thing is to try to figure out always where they're at mentally, which has always been kind of if I could have a decoder ring for covering the Clippers, that's what I would want it to solve, is sort of like, what's this team's mentality right now? How worried are they about kind of, you know, their impending, you know, sort of, I guess the clock that's ticking on this core, is it really even a clock? And kind of, you know, the stuff that we always kind of put on them, I always, if I could ask them one question, just be like, how much of that actually matters to you guys? Because I think you'd get a lot of different answers from that room.
Yeah. How much do you think it matters to them? Because you're right. I mean, we coming into this season, we as kind of a media collective have said it's kind of make or break this year for the Clippers with the guys that can be free agents, the age of certain players. I mean, from asking that question, I mean, how aware do you think they are of that?
Well, I mean, I think they know that we're talking about it. I think part of them, you know, some of them kind of feel like, you know, this really isn't the first time they've heard it, you know, that they heard it going into DeAndre Jordan's free agency. They heard it last year because, you know, last year would be the year to trade Blake Griffin if you were going to trade Blake Griffin and try to get, you know, maximized return. So they've always kind of felt, I think, that, you know, artificial sort of sense of urgency that's placed in them. But, you know, this year it's like, it's nobody, you know, the organization at least is like, you know, they don't have a choice in this anymore. It's sort of on the players now. And I think, you know, if you want to be, you know, kind of like a psychologist about why they've started so strongly, I think that's definitely one of the things you have to talk about, is that this is a team that hasn't really embraced November basketball, you know, maybe since Doc Rivers first took the job. And here they are, what are we, 14 games into the season? I think they play, you know, 15 might be Monday night. And they're playing maybe the best basketball they've played under him, you know, and I think that's not just a coincidence. I think that they wanted to kind of get out to a good, obviously everybody wants to get out to a good start, but I think they really wanted to play with sort of a sense of urgency and try to figure out exactly, you know, is this the group that we want to be a part of? Is this the group we want to win with?
Yeah.
And I think so far, so good on that front.
Yeah, and I think that intensity, at least to my eyes, has manifested itself on the defensive side. I mean, they
100%.
The Clippers were always a pretty good defensive team. I mean, they were sixth last year in defensive efficiency. Mm-hmm. But this year, as we speak on Monday, they're first. And just watching them, I mean, you can see there are very few possessions, Dan, that I see these guys take off. And I don't know if that's always been the case early in the season with this group.
Yeah, so let me tell you a story. This was something that I wrote about earlier this season that stuck out to me, was they're playing Detroit on a Monday night. I think it was a Monday night. And, you know, Blake Griffin is guarding Tobias Harris, who's a good offensive player, and Tobias Harris kind of, you know, puts the ball down, moves to his right, gets into the paint, and makes kind of a floater, like a driving floater. Ball goes through the net, and Blake Griffin, who was guarding him, kind of is there to grab it out. And he kind of slaps the ball in his hands and looks around. He looks ticked off. Like, you know, help was maybe supposed to be there. It wasn't. And Detroit scored, and that meant they were up 28 instead of 30. Mm-hmm. You know, and to me, that was like, that's a kind of a microcosm for how they've, when they've been at their best this season, it's been that same kind of levels of accountability exist when they're up 30 points than, you know, as exists when they're up fit, like five. You know, they're playing those defensive possessions late in games. You see it all the time with DeAndre Jordan. I think that you're starting to see it at Blake Griffin is probably the biggest change, is that he's really playing defense at a different level. And you know, I think, Chris, if you look back to last year, another reason why this defense is playing so well is that, you know, it's continuity. They were, you know, you mentioned sixth overall. I think they were third maybe once they added Luka Mbamute into the starting lineup, who's, mm-hmm. you know, given them kind of a versatile wing defender, a guy who can guard one through four better than they've had at that position. And they've kind of settled in on him at that role. And I think they changed their pick and roll coverage before last year. And I think that they've kind of come into this year way more comfortable on that side of the basketball. And it's just been sort of a pick up where we left off type of thing. And weirdly, the first, you know, week of the season, they were amazing defensively and they were pretty dreadful on offense. And obviously, and that's caught up. And you know what? If both can click at the same time, I mean, they're as good as anybody in the NBA.
Tell me more about what you've seen from Blake this year. The numbers, really, over the last 3 years, they're pretty comparable. I mean, around 21 mm-hmm. points and 7-9 rebounds. He's up at 9. I think it's a career high in rebounds, or at least a 3 or 4 year high in rebounds this year. Is it the defensive end that separates him this year from the guy we've seen over the last few, or is there another layer to it as well?
I mean, I think, look, every year he's kind of come back as a better player in some facet. I mean, you know, the other day he's 10 for 10 from the free throw line. And I remember when I first started covering the team, like, he was terrified of shooting free throws. Mm-hmm. Like, that was not something he wanted to do. And he's worked himself into a, you know, a pretty good free throw shooter. You know, he's worked his perimeter jump shot into a thing that's a reliable weapon that you can't just give him, you know, 19, 20 footers, because he'll shoot and make them. But where I think, like you mentioned, where I think he's really different this year is defensively. And I think there's just an effort and an energy. He's always played really hard. But like, I think you're just seeing it really more on both ends. Doc Rivers has pointed to kind of, you know, his defensive IQ kind of like finally like manifesting on the court, that he's always felt that he was a smart player, but that, you know, maybe kind of the time it would take to process to action would maybe be, you know, a hair too long or something like that. Well, that's gone now. He's comfortable in their system. And I think the second thing, and you know, I don't think we can undersell this, is that this is a guy who had injuries and, you know, a pretty embarrassing off-court mistake take away over half his season last year. And I think he's playing like somebody who really enjoys being back on the court and realizes, you know, the opportunity that they had last year that was kind of squandered. And I think he's playing with more energy and intensity because, you know, he didn't have basketball for such a long period of time last year.
Has the perception of Blake amongst, you know, opponents evolved at all in the last few years? I mean, I was watching that Memphis game, Dan, and it obviously wasn't their best game by any stretch. But, mm-hmm. you know, watching Blake kind of just go toe-to-toe with Zach Randolph and push Marc Gasol and really not give an inch to either one of those guys. I mean, that was pretty impressive to me. And maybe he's done it a lot over the last few years, but it's, you know, Blake had that kind of rep as being kind of a whiner and a little bit of
a guy you could rattle.
Yeah, sure. Guy you could rattle. Yeah, it's a good way to put it. I mean, has that changed in the last couple of years or even this season?
I mean, I think we've seen less of it. You know, I certainly have noticed it less, like the incredibly hard fouls that he was taking.
Yeah.
Now, I wonder if part of that is, you know, he's also not the same kind of like put the ball on the ground and try to embarrass everybody type of player too, that he's become more perimeter based and stuff. I mean, obviously we saw, you know, against the Bulls on Saturday, I mean, he's not afraid to go try and dunk on Robin Lopez and he got him pretty good. But like, even like that play kind of came after, you know, he went in for a layup and saw Robin Lopez was there and kind of tried to move around the contact and make more of a finesse play. And it took kind of Doc Rivers being like, no, just go through him. Like, you can do that. Like, kind of to be reminded of that. It's interesting. I don't feel like guys try to, like, agitate him quite as much. I mean, he I don't think it's fun to play against him. And I don't think guys particularly like playing against him. It's really physical. You know, you're right about kind of the working of the officials and that type of stuff. And I do think that gets under people's skin a little bit, but it's not certainly ending up in the types of like the cheap shots and stuff like that, that he would used to take, or the crazy hard fouls, or even like the Zeebo kind of Greco-Roman wrestling that I was treated to see like 2 years in a row in the playoffs. Like that seems to have kind of gone.
It's easy for players and for a team to, you know, hold hands and kumbaya and say, we always loved each other. The media blew everything out of proportion. I mean, we hear that all the time, but I mean, this group of guys, I mean, the history is what it is. Yeah. You know, there was always the talk about whether it's Chris Paul and DeAndre, Chris Paul and Blake Griffin, about what was that relationship really like? I mean, what's it like now? I mean, what have you noted about the way these guys interact personally? Are they closer or is it the same? I mean, how would you evaluate it?
I mean, right now it seems like Chris and Blake are absolutely on the same page. You know, just like little moments kind of that they've shared in, you know, post-game press conferences and stuff like that. Like watching, you know, Blake interact with Chris Paul's, you know, son, little Chris, just kind of like little things like that I've noticed this year. And not that they didn't happen before, but it just seems like they're kind of locked in right now. And obviously they're winning. And this has never been a team that, you know, hasn't handled winning well. That's never been their problem. It's been when things get really, really tough. You know, I think sometimes they haven't always handled that well. I think, you know, sort of the history with their relationships and stuff like that. I think, you know, Chris Paul is a really competitive player, And I think sometimes his style is grinded on people. And I think that, you know, both Chris and Blake haven't always responded well to that. And I think, Blake and DeAndre. And I think sometimes Chris hasn't, you know, really endeared himself to them either in sort of the way he's spoken to them or the way that, you know, he's been a hard teammate, you know, but I've always felt like they're kind of unified in their common goal. And that's why it's always kind of ended up with everybody kind of coming back. Like all, you know, we'll see what happens this year, but you know, DeAndre had a chance to leave. And Blake didn't have to sign an extension. Chris didn't have to resign. You look at their bench, a guy like Jamal Crawford, he didn't have to, you know, re-sign. Austin Rivers didn't have to re-sign. You know, you kind of go up and down the roster, and it's a group of people who want to be here. And I think that's another thing that, you know, this team, at least it seems like 1 through 15, they're all pointing in the same direction right now.
Yeah. The guy that's made such an impact, Mo Spates. Well, you know, the bargain basement guy. I mean, getting, what, $1.5 million this season, just basically stolen, like so many other Golden State Warriors players were kind of stolen in the aftermath of the Durant signing. What impact has he made on this team?
Well, he gives them something that they haven't had offensively and something that they've tried, you know, since Doc Rivers took over. And that's, a legitimate stretch big man, a guy who can stand out at the three-point line. And you know, what he's done for that second unit, Chris, is, like, he's made – you know, the strength of Raymond Felton, you know, the ability to put the ball on the ground and go to the basket. You know, he's opened up tremendous driving lanes for him, driving lanes for Austin Rivers, driving lanes for Jamal Crawford. I think that's been that. I think, you know, they added, I don't know if like snarl is a category, but I think it's good to have a guy who's like willing to kind of do some dirty work stuff. Like Mo Spates draws charges. He's not the best defensive player, but he'll stand in and take contact. And you know, can play with some toughness, got a really tough offensive rebound against the Bulls and made a great pass late in that game. And, you know, I think he's comfortable here because he knows that his minutes are going to be pretty consistent. You know, he said something like that to me the other day after the Bulls game where, you know, Doc Rivers had benched him in the first half after 4 minutes. And he said he'd kind of, you know, I think he implied that he kind of went back to the Golden State days where, you know, things didn't go well. That team was so deep, they know they could go in a different direction. Well, you know, at the end of that first half, Doc turned back to Mo after playing him for only 4 minutes in his first stretch in the rotation, which is light for him, about half the time you would normally play, and put him back in for the last offensive possession. And Mo told me that, you know, that gave him so much confidence, knowing that, you know, Doc Rivers had his back like that. And you know, sure enough, he goes out and makes three threes in the second half and helps them come back and get a really tough win against the Bulls, a win that I think when Doc Rivers saw the schedule at the beginning of the year, he just pretty much marked as a loss, a schedule loss. And Mo Spates was, I mean, he's the reason they won that game.
I think we're all kind of gearing up for December 7th, that first matchup with Golden State. I remember watching the preseason game, Dan, and I know it's preseason, but you know, watching them just get just trampled by Golden State. I wondered if that would have a mental effect, frankly, like just watching the Warriors do what they did. But you know, how do you see this Clipper team matching up with Golden State, who they're invariably going to have to go through to get what they want to get?
I think in theory and on paper, some of the things the Clippers do well kind of line up against some of the things the Warriors might struggle with. And I wish this is a podcast. You can't see me putting air quotes around struggle, but I think the Clippers are big and they play, two traditional big men in DeAndre Jordan and Blake Griffin, and they're guys that are athletic enough to guard multiple positions. So I think that allows them to kind of do some switching and stuff like that, which helps them. And that's something they've certainly worked on a lot this year. They've switched more defensively this season than they have in the past. And I think, they've got a lot of depth, and that's another area where maybe the Warriors are vulnerable. Where the Clippers do have, can go 11 or 12 deep. For instance, Wes Johnson's hurt right now. Brandon Bass wasn't working out in a couple, and they broke the glass on, in case of emergency on Paul Pierce, and he played well for two games, and hit some, I think he hit three threes in those two games, had a drive in the paint that looked kind of vintage Paul Pierce. Having those little tricks up your sleeve, I think that gives them a little bit more of an advantage. They can play, I think, more different ways than the Warriors. But it's still going to come down to, are they good enough defensively? I mean, that's the ultimate stress test is, how are they going to be able one-on-one to win some of those matchups? Because I think that they're too talented to do it just 100% on team defense, the Warriors. I think you've got to figure out ways, can Luke and Bamute do enough on offense where you can play him for 30 minutes?
It's hard to watch Paul Pierce kind of be that break the glass on guy at this point in his career. Did you ask him why he came back?
We've talked to him about it briefly. I don't know that we got the most honest answer. I think certainly the paycheck doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think Yeah, but I do think it's just kind of, one last trip to kind of savor everything. He's definitely been more outgoing, around us and the media and stuff like that this year. Whereas last year at times he would be kind of a headphones on or, hiding in the back pregame. It seems like he's kind of soaking things in more this year. Obviously, Halloween night, dressing like Rick James. Mm-hmm. Coming out of the court, posing for pictures with fans and stuff like that. I mean, he seemed really happy. One of the cool things that I've seen from Paul Pierce this year, and it's something that I think I'll remember, long down the road, is the time watching him work out with Diamond Stone, the Clippers second round pick. Those two guys have kind of gravitated towards each other. Stone's in the D League right now, but before he was sent down, where before every practice, every shoot around, those two guys playing one-on-one, that's a guy who, Paul's been in the league since Diamond was, born. And Diamond Stone's a big man. They play different positions. It doesn't matter. They're trash talking. Paul's going at him. Paul's mad when he's losing. He's trash talking when he's winning. And he seemed to have really kind of embraced that part of the season. Now, I'm sure he wants to be on the court more. Mm-hmm. I'm positive, just in terms of, his competitive drive and his competitive spirit. But I think, knowing that he's having a big impact on the life of a younger guy in this league, someone who wants to learn and stuff like that, he seems to have taken that to heart and really enjoyed kind of that part of this process for him.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me, because when he was debating what to do, I had, at least one current NBA coach call me and say, is Paul Pierce retiring? If he is, can you get a message to him saying I'll hire him on my staff? I think he's got that future. He's, said publicly he'd love to get into the front office, and I think Boston would be a likely place for him to kind of start that post-playing career. But there are a lot of options. That's why it did kind of surprise me, because I agree with you. Like, he wants to play. he still believes there's something kind of left in the tank. But you know, based on what we saw last year and what we've seen earlier this season, it's more of like, I mean, I would think, Dan, it's more of like this, if you can find that rare matchup where it works, you play Paul Pierce. Otherwise, you've got to go with other guys.
You're right. I mean, he's not part of their rotation plans. I think if everybody's healthy, you know, and that was clear, even though Paul was hurt to start the season, had a weird thing where he stepped on a sideline reporter's foot in their final preseason game and sprained his ankle. You know, once he was healthy, there weren't minutes there for him. And one of what I think Blake Griffin called it, one of the most Paul Pierce things ever, you know, last Friday in Sacramento, you know, his number's called. And the first time he touches the ball, he makes, you know, a perfect pass to Austin Rivers, gets an assist. Second time he touches the ball, he drills a three. And like, this is somebody who hadn't, like, I mean, not a second of court time since the preseason. Mm-hmm. And even then wasn't playing a lot. And to see, you know, kind of that level of professionalism, that level of kind of commitment to your craft to just be ready in that moment, I think, you know, that went noticed in that locker room. And I think that kind of enables him to be a good fit and guys enjoy having him around, enjoy rooting for him. And I think, you know, I don't know that that's enough for him to make this a good year. It's hard. I'll be curious to know kind of after he's done, when he looks back on it, if that was enough to kind of make it worth it. But, you know, because he's not a big attention guy. I mean, he's not looking for the, you know, the rocking chair tributes and stuff like that. Right. He'll get a couple of them, but that's not really what he's in this for. I think it's just to be in that room and kind of have those interactions one more time. At least that's what it seems like to me.
Are the Clippers, is Doc Rivers, are they comfortable with what they're getting out of that small forward spot now? Like, Mbah Mute's been the guy for them, and he's a very good defensive player, but that's clearly been kind of a question mark for this team over the last few years. Who was going to be, you know, player five in that big four? How comfortable are they with the players, specifically Mbah Mute, that they're plugging into that spot?
I would say they're more committed than they are comfortable, mm-hmm. probably, but they're committed. And I think they found someone who works for them defensively, which is ultimately, I think, when they look around at that group, is the most important thing. To have somebody there who can, you know, guard Damian Lillard one night and Anthony Davis the next. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a big, they haven't really had that before Luke. And I think what's been kind of interesting is, so they made some small tweaks to their offense, adding things more, like more player movement and stuff like that when they get into some ISO sets. And, you know, finding him once or twice a game on a cut for a layup, you know, in the playoffs, like those baskets are backbreakers. Like whenever Tony Allen would score on you in the playoffs, like it feels like you're giving up 6 points instead of two. Because that's not the guy you're worrying about. And if, you know, and I think when you have Luke in the corner, whether he makes one corner three, or if you turn your head and you know, go to double Blake Griffin and he cuts on the baseline, you can find him for a layup. You know, those baskets carry a lot of weight, and they've done more this season. You know, minor thing, I think he's scoring like 6 points a game, but he was scoring three last year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, doubling that output, making him a smidge more credible on offense, I think has made that group more dangerous. And then I think they just kind of look at their bench and they kind of like their other options. You know, they like how Wes Johnson has kind of been as sort of a small ball four. I don't think they view him as a starting three on this team. I think they like him in his role. Allen Anderson is just not healthy enough. And I think in Doc's opinion, like they just don't trust that foot enough to like fully commit to making a change with him. And you know, and Paul is Paul at this point, not really a small forward. You know, so Luke's certainly the best option they have, and the way he's played so far, Chris, I don't think it, you know, obviously look, if there's a great deal out there to be made for a two-way small forward, I'm sure they'd be interested, but I don't think they feel a huge sense of urgency right now, the way he's played. He's been really good for them.
So take health out of the equation as we get into this Clipper season and move into like the playoff kind of thought process. I mean, what's the biggest question mark for this team?
I would say it's like, you know, how close are they operating to their ceiling right now? You know, is that, so they're a team that's benefited from tremendous continuity. They're a team that's benefited from, you know, knowing each other for all this time. The Warriors are going to get better. I don't think there's any question that they're going to be a better team in game 80 than they're going to be in game 15. And I think it's, you know, where do the Clippers find ways to get better over the course of the season? Now they always do. That's always been a Doc Rivers thing, but You know, if we're talking about a team that's leading the league in defensive efficiency, is second in offensive efficiency, like, where are we going to find these places to really improve? I think bench consistency will be a big thing. That group got off to a really good start defensively. You know, can that be sustained? They've struggled a little bit after Wes Johnson went out. I think, you know, how creative will Doc Rivers be with lineups is something that I'm interested to see. Will they, you know, go crazy small? We saw them in a preseason game start, you know, Austin Rivers, Raymond Felton, and Chris Paul all together. Not that I think we're going to see that in a starting lineup, but could you see that first stretch in a game? Will they go jumbo, which is something else they can do with Mos Bates, DeAndre, and Blake Griffin? Will they experiment with those things and find these things that where they think, here's 6 minutes, we absolutely have to win, but here's a lineup that can't be matched? I think that'll have, to me, that's the big question, is can they find all these little tiny strategic advantages? Because, I mean, I kind of feel like what we're looking at right now, and they're going to get better, Chris, but I mean, this is a pretty good version of them.
I feel like you have to go jumbo, right?
They would sign up to take, I think, a version of this play, you know, into the playoffs, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like in the playoffs, if you play Golden State, you've got to go jumbo. I think if you try to play down to them, you're not going to win. You're just not going to win that matchup. You have to. I've always believed that the only way you can beat Golden State is to make them, force them to pay for having Zaza Pachulia and JaVale McGee and you know, whatever flotsam they throw out there. The strength of the Clippers is their strength, and to me, that the only thing that gives them a chance is if they can make Golden State play up to them. It's hard, and it's not something Golden State's likely to do, but I don't know. I just, if they try to get into a track meet, I don't see how it's going to help them.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if you can put yourself in a position where you're confident enough that Blake Griffin is able to guard either Kevin Durant or Andre Iguodala, you know, that gives them a tremendous advantage, right? If you feel good enough about where you're at defensively to do that, you can do some really interesting things against them. One of the kind of the weird things, and I'll be curious to see if they do this, and you know this from watching Doc, is like, generally Doc like doesn't really care about offensive rebounding.
Yeah.
And I think that's a place, and we saw Oklahoma City do this in the playoffs last year. That's a place where you can kind of get after the Warriors a little bit. And you know, Doc has always values transition defense, which is also super important against the Warriors. I'll be curious to see when they first play, you know, can the Clippers get, you know, 14 to 16 second chance points in that game because of their size, because of DeAndre Jordan, because of Blake Griffin. And if they can do that, I think that'll give us a little bit of insight into maybe the way you'd want to play them in a playoff series. But I also think the other important thing for the Clippers is to not think about playing the Warriors in the playoffs, because I've been down this road with them a lot of times where it looks like that's inevitable and something really weird happens. And so I think just focusing kind of on the 48 minutes in front of you, this team has been pretty good at that so far this year. And I think if they can kind of stay in the moment like that, I think that'll give them, you know, the right kind of mindset going into the playoffs.
Well, Dan, enjoy this upcoming road trip. I'm sure there's plenty of Subway sandwiches in your future. Cheap beer.
I don't do the national Subway. I don't do the national chains. I like the regional sandwiches.
You're a man of the people, are you?
Yeah, like, you know, the Jimmy John's in one pocket of the country, the Potbelly somewhere else. That's important to me. I like to know what the people are in the region I'm at, where they're getting their, you know, turkey and Swiss.
Yeah,
that's how I connect.
Because Jimmy John's is really, that's really, you know, going
very, very authentic.
Authentic, you know, Midwestern flavor. If it says it's authentic, it doesn't necessarily mean it's authentic, just because they say it is. Dan, thanks for joining me, man. I appreciate it.
Anytime, buddy.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Bobby Marks and Dan Wojcicki for joining the show. A reminder that you can download this podcast and other archive podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, really anywhere you can download podcasts. If you like it, post a comment, give us a rating. You know I appreciate it. While you're there, check out The Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and The Vertical Podcast with Woj. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.